From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavi Smiley. On today's program, broadcast journalist Geraldo Rivera joins us to explain his recent controversial comments about the impact of hip-hop on black and brown youth. And we'll bring you a conversation with Eddie Redmayne, who won the Best Actor Oscar this week for his riveting portrayal of Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. But first, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has not thrown his hat into the presidential campaign ring for 2016 just yet, but he has said repeatedly that he's prepared to run if no one steps up to fill a left-of-center vacancy in the Democratic primary field. He joins us from Washington after a three-day visit to Iowa. Senator Sanders, good to have you back on this program, sir.
Good to be with you, Tavis.
Your trip to Iowa was for what purpose?
Well, it is no secret that I'm giving thought to running for president of the United States. And I think, Tavis, when I go to Iowa, when I go to other states around the country, there is massive discontent among middle-income and working-class people about the state of the economy. They see themselves working longer hours for low wages. They worry very much about the future for their kids. And meanwhile, they're seeing 99% of all new income going to the top 1% in this country, experiencing a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality. So there is a strong feeling, in my view, all over this country, that we need fundamental changes in the way we do economics and in the way we do politics. And that's what I've been talking about.
There are some who believe that Hillary Clinton, should she get in the race, and all the indicators are that she will, given that John Podesta recently left the White House to go work for the Clintons. So there are many who believe that she is the presumptive Democratic nominee if she gets in. We saw news a few days ago of a secret meeting between she and Senator Warren some weeks ago. I wonder whether or not Hillary Clinton has asked for a meeting with you. It appears that she's meeting with people and trying to get some advice, and I wonder if she's reached out to you at this point.
No, she has not.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. I guess what I'm getting at is what it would take for you to not get in the race. As I said a moment ago, you said repeatedly that you're prepared to run if no one left of center gets in. So what does that mean?
Well, what it means, it's not just left the center. Look, Tavis, this country faces enormous problems today. And at the end of the day, in my view, what we have to realize is that it is absolutely imperative to put together a strong grassroots movement that takes on the billionaire class. And I can't describe it any simpler than that. You can't ignore the reality that the top 1% has unbelievable economic power, and as a result of Citizens United, now has extraordinary political power.
And you don't think that Hillary Clinton would or could or will do that?
I don't know. I agree with you. I think she's probably running. I don't know that I know that for definitively. And I don't know what she's going to be campaigning on. But I do know that we need candidates who will make it very clear that we cannot have government policy dominated by the top 1% for the 1%. That's wrong. And that is what kind of the efforts that I've been making throughout my entire political life. And if Hillary Clinton decides to run and I decide to run, we're going to have very good debates, you know, about the role of Wall Street in our society, about trade policy, about foreign policy. And these are the kinds of debates that absolutely need to take place. Because unless, in my view, my strong view, unless we rally millions and millions of people to say the government has got to work for all of us and not just the billionaire class, I worry very much about the future of the American economy for working families and about a political process which will be owned by the Koch brothers and a handful of other billionaire families.
I want to ask about the Koch brothers in just a second. I saw your comments warning of the danger of the growing influence of the Koch brothers. We'll come to that in just a second. One other question about Hillary right quick, though. If folks are lining up behind her already, what is it about her message, her lack of message, what she has said or not said, that gives you reason to believe that she won't carry the water on those issues?
Well, I can't speak for Hillary Clinton, you know, and you'll have to talk to Hillary about that. All I can tell you is when I go to Iowa and I go to other parts or places around the country, people want strong voices to be standing up for a declining middle class, a middle class which has been steadily in decline for 40 years, for the 45 million people who are living in poverty today. People want voices standing up for them. Mm-hmm. And they can make a decision how good or not good Hillary Clinton is. But what I have been talking about are the issues facing working families and the need to go forward. The political problem we have is that can we, at a time when so many people are politically demoralized, put together the kinds of grassroots movement we need in 50 states in this country? Can we raise not an equivalent sum of money to the Koch brothers, but enough money to run a strong grassroots campaign? And Tavis, that's what I'm ascertaining right now, to see whether we can do that.
The Koch brothers have come up now twice in this conversation. As I intimated earlier, I saw you on ABC's This Week, where you warned of the growing influence of the Koch brothers.
It is likely within a very short period of time that the Koch brothers themselves will have a stronger political presence than either the Democratic or the Republican Party.
What most scares you about what they're doing with their money and the money that they're corralling for the 2016 race?
It's not just the 2016 race. For the 2016 race, they are saying that they and a few of their friends are prepared to spend some $900 million. That is almost as much as Obama or Mitt Romney spent in their entire campaigns. But I think these guys who are worth $100 billion could easily double that amount. It doesn't matter to them. They have an endless supply of money. But Tavis, what people don't know is, what do these guys stand for? What do they want? And the truth is, they are radical right-wing extremists who in the past have made it clear they want to end Social Security, they want to end Medicare, they want to end Medicaid, they want to end public education, they want more tax breaks for the rich and large corporations, they want no limits at all on campaign financing. They think Citizens United has not gone far enough, and they want to be able to make direct contributions to candidates at every level of government. This is a radical, right-wing, extremist agenda. And if we don't stop them, this country is going to go back to the 1920s, where virtually every piece of legislation that we have passed since FDR has been killed and eliminated, including Social Security.
I hear your phrase, if we don't stop them. It's not just a matter of stopping them at this point. It's more of a matter, I guess, of educating the people in this country about their agenda, because the Supreme Court has made it clear with their decision that they can't be stopped, that is. So when you say we have to stop them, how do we, what agency do people have, citizens have, to stop them from spending whatever they want to spend, given the decisions that have already come down by the courts?
Well, first of all, we need a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And there are some 17 states that are already on record in supporting that. And I think, Tavis, by the way, this is not just a progressive issue. Mm-hmm. I think honest conservatives understand that we are seeing a major assault on the foundations of American democracy when one family may in the next few years have a more powerful political presence than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. Nobody I know thinks that has anything to do with democracy. So I think you need to overturn Citizens United through a constitutional amendment. I think we need public funding of elections, and we need a strong national grassroots movement to make that happen. You go to Iowa, mm-hmm. and no matter what people's political views are, they are so disgusted by the enormous number of negative TV ads that I think they and people all over this country want to see that end. But look, at the end of the day, nothing gets accomplished. We don't create the jobs that we need to do. We don't raise the minimum wage. We don't have a national health care program. We don't have pay equity unless we create a national grassroots political movement which says enough is enough. The billionaires can't have it all. Right now, 99% of all new income is going to the top 1%. Does anyone think that makes sense? Billionaires are able to buy elections. Who thinks that's right? But the question, Tavis, is, are the American people so demoralized, have they really thrown in the towel, that they are saying in their heart of hearts, nothing we could do about it? Or can we rally people to say no? What Lincoln was saying at Gettysburg, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's our goal, not a government of the billionaires.
You've come up with a way you believe that we can cut tuition in half at public colleges and universities. Tell me how that works right quick.
We can cut tuition completely in public colleges and universities. Look, just one example. The President of the United States wants to increase military spending by $37 billion. If you did nothing else, and I would do more, if you cut that increase in half, You had the states match that $18 billion. Guess what? You've done away with tuition, all tuition, at public colleges and universities throughout America. Period.
I like it. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, thinking tonight about whether or not he would throw his hat in the ring to run for president in 2016 if the right persons don't get in the race. We'll see what happens in the coming months and weeks. Senator Sanders, always good to have you on this program, sir. Thanks for your time.
Good to be with you, Tavis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. When asked about my broadcast career, I've often said that if you like me, credit Geraldo Rivera, and if you loathe me, blame Geraldo Rivera. It was Geraldo who first put me on national television back in the early 90s, and the rest, as they say, is history. He is, of course, an award-winning investigative reporter, author, and talk show host. Of late, though, Geraldo has been in some hot water for some comments he recently made about the impact of hip-hop on black and brown youth.
Hip-hop has done more damage to black and brown people than racism in the last 10 years. When you find the youngster, a Puerto Rican from the South Bronx or a black kid from Harlem, who has succeeded in life other than being the 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% that make it in the music business, that's been a success in life, walking around with his pants around his and with visible tattoos, or it is this whole ethos. And I love Russell Simmons. He's a dear friend of mine. I admire his business acumen. At some point, those guys have to cop to the fact that by encouraging this distinctive culture that is removed from the mainstream, they have encouraged people to be so different from the mainstream that they can't participate other than, the racks and the garment center and those entry-level jobs. And I lament it. I really do. I think that it has been very destructive culturally.
Geraldo joins us now to talk about those controversial remarks. I guess I should start by asking whether or not you lament anything about the comment, or are you okay with it in retrospect?
Well, I lament, Tavis. First of all, I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
I lament that it was the beginning of a discussion, not the end of a discussion. Mm-hmm. And what really bothers me about gangster rap particularly, mm-hmm. I mean, Saul, my 9-year-old, who sings hip-hop, mm-hmm. or does the whole routine, the dance number and all mm-hmm. the rest of it. She loves Drake and Chris Brown, blah, blah, blah. The thing about it, on the front page of the New York Times, is the story of a kid named Bobby Shmurda. Mm-hmm. That's his hip-hop name.
I saw that story, yeah.
He's a kid who's been involved in gangs and violence and rapping about it, and was embraced by the Tonight Show, and now he's in jail on $2 million bond behind a 101-count indictment, including murder, and his buddies also. When you extol the virtue of a lifestyle that is exactly the antithesis of what we need for our children, mm-hmm. I have some real issues with it. And I just think that when you now to I just want to go back to what I lament about the when I made a broad statement, it's done more damage than racism in the last decade. What's my evidence to support that? I don't have any evidence to support that, but I see what I see. I'm a person who gets around. I know a lot of people. I come from a very, rocky background mm-hmm. myself. And I think that these young people need positive role models. They need you. They need me. They need to know that they can participate. I'm an integrationist. Too much of hip-hop is self-segregating. And when you look at those lyrics and hear young people, mimicking basically what they're hearing, we have a real problem in this country with urban violence. It's an epidemic with domestic violence, in our neighborhoods. It's something that I think has to be addressed, and never is. Because why? Because Jay-Z is the friend of the president, and P. Diddy, and Snoop is, everybody loves Snoop. But I mean, all of them had their own run-ins with the law. When you look, like here in L.A., I talk about Bobby Shmurda in New York. Suge Knight mm-hmm. runs over a guy, kills him. Suge Knight, who gave a lift to Tupac.
Allegedly. Yeah, you're the lawyer here.
That's right. But I'm just saying that this is a dead-end street. It is entertaining, but it is not life-affirming.
I know you, so I know what you meant when you made the comment. But that's why I wanted, since you were in town, I thought I'd have you on the program to talk about it. Because there are a few things I think that you should answer to. One, why hip-hop? Why not rock and roll? Why do you think hip-hop has done damage and rock or some other punk rock or some other form of rock has not? Why hip-hop?
The difference between rock and hip-hop is in the drug, gun, violent culture. Rock and roll emphasized and glamorized sex, drugs. Mm-hmm. I don't know people that get killed behind rock and roll. I know people who get killed behind hip hop. I think there's a big difference in terms of cultural impact. There's a world of difference between a rock fan, even a punk rock fan, who may be removing themselves from society. I lament that too, but they're, in terms of numbers, you're talking vast swaths, millions. The way these people that I mentioned earlier became multi-mega millionaires is that people spend their hard-earned money to live like they live. This whole idea. What in the world is the point of wearing your pants around your... Just saying. What is it mimicking? We know what it's mimicking.
Prison life.
Why would you want to idealize prison life?
You know as well as I do that the overwhelming majority, some studies as much as 75 or 80% of hip-hop is purchased by white kids.
Right.
You started the conversation earlier by talking about your kids listen to hip-hop.
Right.
So why black and brown kids being damaged by it but not infiltrating the minds and attitudes of white kids who listen to it as much as black kids do?
White kids don't live in the hood. By and large,
but the hood is a state of mind. It's not just an environment.
It is.
It's not either or.
I agree that the hood is a state of mind, but it is also a very physical place. It is a place where there is dread, mm-hmm. a place where there is violence, a place where there are, like Ferguson, Missouri. Everybody's mm-hmm. pointing to Ferguson. St. Louis County had 7 homicides mm-hmm. in one night a couple of weeks ago. That's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the real, raw impact this is having on a very vulnerable population. And I hate self-segregation. You know, I'm old enough, I'm way older than you, and I'm old enough now to go back to the old. I hate self-segregation because I embrace integration. Mm-hmm. I'm an old integrationist. What would Dr. King say about these lyrics and the role model that's being put forth, that you have to have a run-in to have credibility. Mm-hmm. You have to be run afoul of the law, get shot 9 times like 50 Cent. You got to, well, Lil Wayne, or you've got to, you know, to be in prison and go through all that. I mean, come on. When did that become a virtue? When did antisocial behavior and violence, usually against someone else of color, become something to aspire to?
Yeah, I don't think it's a virtue. I think that what some of these rappers, not all, I grant you, what some of them are talking about is the overcoming of that lifestyle and being able to do something else with the gift and the talent that they have. To your credit, though, there are some who are just faking the funk. I mean, they haven't even lived this stuff, but they rap about it. They have an image about that, an image that purports a certain kind of street cred that they really don't have. So I'm not saying that you're completely wrong about what you're saying. I'm just saying that I think that we too often want to blame the black and brown kids who are forced to live in these hoods that you talked about earlier, rather than spending our time on TV talking about ways to help them get out of the situations that they're in. So we bastardize hip-hop, but we don't talk about the conditions that these black folk have to navigate every day.
Well, that's obviously a fair point. We have an unequal society, and it's getting more and more unequal as time goes by. I wish the president spoke about it more. I do. I know that you feel that sometimes the president is lecturing black America. I wish he did more of that, to talk to the kids in the South Bronx, the Puerto Rican kids, and tell them to, you know, pull their pants up and go ahead and, you know, get as educated as they possibly can be.
One of the things one of the comments I've seen about you from a number of people since this first happened was that, when did Geraldo become so counterculture? I mean, I've known you for a long time.
You've been Trayvon Martin's dad.
There are folk who feel that you've been in Fox News so long that your politics have become so conservative
but
now.
But I think that when Trayvon was killed, and I got my first, really, that's where I really ran afoul of the main angle in for people of color. That's where I really, because that's always been my core audience. Sure. It's always been my go-to audience. Mm-hmm. That's who supported me in my long career in daytime television. Let's face it, that's Eyewitness mm-hmm. News, Good Night America. It was always the minority audience. Mm-hmm. It's like, Empire on Fox News. Why mm-hmm. is it such a big hit? I had that audience. That was my audience. Mm-hmm. So Trayvon Martin was the first time. Why was I so upset about Trayvon Martin, aside from the loss of life of the teenager? It's because when you look like a 7-Eleven surveillance video of a stick-up, then nothing good's going to happen to you. I'm telling you, when I walk around and I see a kind of all-weather hoodie wear where you can't see the person's face and the pants are down around the no one's going to hire that person. Don't we want those children to be somebody?
I totally agree. You may not be hired sporting that kind of look, but we're not talking about Trayvon getting hired. We're talking about whether or not justifies Trayvon being killed, and that sort of image that causes society to demonize black men in a certain way and then allows them to be assassinated and killed in the street, oftentimes by law enforcement, and then law enforcement gets away with that. You can't blame that on a hoodie or pants hanging down, Geraldo. That's all I'm saying.
You can't. If you are a stereotype, if you live a stereotype, people are going to treat you like a stereotype, Tavis. That's what's so upsetting to me.
But when white kids wear hoodies and have their pants saying that, they don't get killed.
But a white kid wears a hoodie in a shopping mall in the suburbs.
But they don't get killed
for
it.
My son, who, Cruz.
Sure, know him well.
All right.
Love him.
Cruz, the difference between Cruz and Gabriel. Gabriel's out here. Cruz was much more tattoos early, chaos. He has a tattoo on his back. I almost, at his age, I almost spanked him when I saw that. Always wearing the hoodie. Cops stopping him time and time again. Busted for reefer, and it's not a big deal, but it chops up your life. It impacts you in a negative way. As a parent dealing with it myself, I see the impact. And I'm a powerful, relatively affluent person. I could take care of any problem. But I'm not the typical Puerto Rican dad. And if you burden these children with what you're doing is you are giving them an extra mile that they have to go to get even. And they have enough problems. I just think that when the culture of guns and violence and drugs becomes an ideal that you need to wallow in to have credibility to be successful, and the only people that would be successful are the 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%, I was right about that, then I think, although I understand the wonderful informational and entertainment value of hip-hop, and a lot of people have been happy about a lot of lyrics and a lot of performers, there is this aspect of it that I think is very, to use the words I use there. And I'm sorry I picked this fight. I mean, I needed this fight like I needed a hole in the head. I got so much going on, I'm telling you. But I just having said it and having been drawn in and Russell hitting me over the head with TMZ and all the rest of it, I had to defend myself because I believe it. I shouldn't have gratuitously brought it up when the guy was asking me.
And I'll close on this note. I don't think that you were wrong for bringing it up. That wasn't my issue. When I saw you as your friend, what I felt was that you painted with a broad brush.
I agree.
When you say hip-hop, that's a whole lot of people. That's a massive culture.
And now you're talking about
Common, who just won an Academy Award the other night.
I apologize.
You're talking about Common, you're talking about Lauryn Hill, you're talking about a bunch of folks. So that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that was my issue. I said, I got to get Geraldo on the show to let him know that, you know what, I take your point and I don't even disagree with you. But the broad brush is what got me.
I agree with that.
But I love you.
And I love you.
And I know your heart's in the right place.
And I'm so glad I discovered you.
I'm glad you did too. I close where I began. If you like me, thank Geraldo. If you hate me, blame Geraldo. He is the guy, no jokes, no joke here. He is the guy 20 years ago that put me on TV for the very first time and kept me there. And here I am all these years later. The Academy Awards were announced this past Sunday night, and in the run-up to the glitzy evening, we were pleased to have a wide range of Oscar nominees on our PBS program. Among them, Eddie Redmayne, who took home the Best Actor Oscar for his portrayal of Professor Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything.
It's brilliant. Brilliant, Stephen. Superb. Therefore, all there is to say is well done. Or perhaps I should say, to be more precise, well done, Doctor.
Bravo, Stephen.
An extraordinary theory.
Thank you.
So what next?
Prove it. Prove with a single equation that time had a beginning. Wouldn't that be nice, Professor?
I leaned over to Eddie when the clip was playing and said, you were just brilliant in this. You were so brilliant. He said, I was so scared. What was so scary for you?
Oh, God, where to start? When I read the script, uh-huh. I thought I was going to read a piece about Stephen's life. Mm-hmm. And what I read was this incredibly passionate and beautiful, complicated love story about two formidable people. Mm. And I'm one of those people, when I see a film, I believe it to be true. The sort of authenticity of the camera and seeing things on the screen. And so it felt like this formidable privilege to get to play him, but also to tell their story truthfully. It felt like a high stakes game. Ultimately, I knew that they would see the film and they would be the ultimate reviewers. So it was quite terrifying, but wonderful at the same time.
Felicity was here not too long ago. And I had a chance to ask her what it was like to meet Jane Hawking. And I want to ask you what it was like to meet Stephen in a second, but let's see what Felicity had to say about meeting Jane Hawking first.
When I met her, you know, I thought she was going to, she's formidable, the way that, what she coped with in her life. And then I met her, she was just really welcoming. She was very, very warm and actually showed me pictures of her and Stephen Hawking when they first met. Mm-hmm. And there were all these images of them just looking really cool, and it was in the 60s, and, you know, they're sort of like sitting on this boat and looking very just like normal young people falling in love. So I really felt like she gave me this insight into their lives.
I jumped so fast on that. For those at home who have not seen the film yet, first of all, shame on you. You got to go see it. You got to see this movie. But Felicity Jones plays, as I'm sure you figured out, Jane Hawking in the film, The Theory of Everything. So that was her take on meeting Jane. Mm. Now, your take on meeting Stephen.
Well, gosh, what was amazing actually just seeing Felicity talk there is I remember going to see Felicity and Jane after they had just met. We were invited around for dinner. And I arrived in Jane's home, knocked on the door and walked in, and they were sitting in her wardrobe, trying on her old clothes. Literally, wedding dresses were brought down. It was kind of a wonderful thing to witness. So I met Stephen a few days before that. It was just a few days before we started filming. Mm. And I'd been prepping for 4 months, and I'd wanted to meet Stephen, you know, as early as possible, but he's an incredibly busy man.
Yeah.
Has quite an intense schedule out there. And so when I went to meet him, it was this very complicated thing by which I had spent months researching him, and he had gone from this sort of icon status to sort of idol status. And when I actually got to meet him, I was so nervous by this point, because I'd watched everything and read everything, that I arrived and I just couldn't stop talking. I had like nervous chatter, and I just started flooding him with information about himself. It was pretty catastrophic, I'm not going to lie. And then eventually I calmed down, and he was so generous. He was funny, he was witty, he was insightful. But it's a very interesting dynamic, because he has on his glasses, he has a sensor with a computer screen and the alphabet, and this cursor goes across the alphabet, and when he moves the muscle just beneath his cheek, it stops on one letter. So when you're having a live conversation with Stephen, there are long, long pauses. Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of, it's a really unique rhythm. And so it was a really interesting experience. Yeah.
Speaking of rhythm, Eddie, how did you get into the rhythm of playing him? I mean, you mentioned earlier that he was very insightful. Was he insightful about how to play him?
Yeah, I mean, in that first meeting, it was more about getting a sense of his character, what he emanates, which is this passion, this joy, this wit, this power, actually. He can move very few muscles, and yet it's as if all of the facilities that we have of gesture, of tone of voice, all of those energies are channeled into those few muscles that he can move. And so really it was, for someone He has the most charismatic of faces, and for me that was, you're sort of speaking to him and meeting him, but also trying to observe. Mm-hmm. He also said a few specific things, like he asked me if I was playing him before the voice machine. Mm-hmm. And I said yes, and he said, well, my voice was very slurred. And there was one bit of documentary material of Stephen speaking, and it's in the 80s, just before his tracheotomy. Mm-hmm. And to my ears, or to our ears, he's completely incomprehensible, because the tongue muscle had stopped working. But Jane could understand him, mm-hmm. and his students could understand him. And if you wanted to be one of his students, you went and spent a couple of weeks learning to understand him. But the film company were worried about going that far, because they were worried about having subtitles.
Yeah.
And so when I said to Stephen, I was like, I know that your voice was very slurred, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to take it to that level. And he said, well, couldn't you have someone translate me? And it was wonderful to hear from him, because it meant that I could go back to the writer and the director galvanized and mm-hmm. say, look, it's the one thing, the authenticity to the disease is something Stephen cares about hugely. And the writer then wrote in some scenes in which Felicity translates mm-hmm. me. So that was a specific thing.
Wow. When you said a moment ago that he communicates with his face, that you, when you were talking to him, you wanted to look at his face and size up his character. Mm. Tell me what you took from being that close to him and looking into his face. I ask that because what works in this film so well is your face. I mean, you are so communicative through your face. What did you see in Hawking's face?
Well, just character. I mean, just when he smiles, when Stephen smiles, it's like you get the most gigantic hug. It's like the most wonderful feeling. It's and all of that minutiae and the smallness of the movements, but really seeing how communicative that is. Like, so for example, when it takes, as I was saying, a long time for Stephen to communicate mm-hmm. a word, but so he has a shorthand. So if you're asking him a question, a yes will be a sort of slight smile, and a no will be what's a sort of small mm-hmm. grimace. There's a sort of shorthand, which, I mean, I don't understand as well as those nurses who've worked with him for years and years and years. But what I was so lucky about on this film was that I knew that a lot of the communication would have to be through the small. Mm-hmm. And of course, film sees all that. Cameras mm-hmm. are really up there in mm-hmm. your face and capturing every minute detail, so it's helpful.
Yeah. What's been your takeaway from the journey that he's navigated? We'll come to the brilliance in just a second, but just what he has to go through every day. What's been your personal takeaway from watching someone? You played him on screen, mm. but what do you make of that?
Well, it was interesting because I only met Stephen later on in his life, but in preparing to make the film, I went to an ALS clinic in London and met maybe 30 or 40 people living with ALS. We met their families, Felicity and I, and that was extraordinary for me. This is a disease in which you are given a few years to live, and Stephen always describes it. He was given 2 years to live, and he says every day beyond that was a gift. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, he is someone that fills every second. He values time. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm one of those people that gets caught up in the sort of banalities and neuroses of mm-hmm. the everyday. And really, it was just this wonderful thing of going, make sure you live. We've only got one shot at this. You know, make sure you live every moment fully mm-hmm. and passionately. And the other thing I took away is that, I mean, the film is very specific to Stephen and Jane's story, but they had so many obstacles put in their way, mm-hmm. so many limitations forced on them. But they've refused to be defined by those limitations, but rather by how you overcome them or how mm-hmm. you supersede them. And whilst, you know, it's very specific to those circumstances, I feel like in life we all have things that are, mm-hmm. you're told no, you're told, and how you choose to battle those things is really what defines us.
Yeah. See, I see this film and I come up with a number of things, not the least of which, Eddie, is that there are just no excuses. Yeah. I mean, when you are able-bodied, mm. you know, we just had Marcus Roberts here not long ago, the great piano, yeah. a pianist who's been blind for most of his life. And yet he's, you know, writing compositions mm. and scores and mm. and when you're able-bodied like you are and I am, you see a movie like Theory of Everything and you're like, man, I gotta stop making excuses.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what I love about Stephen is he always finds the positive. So he'll talk about the fact that yes, ALS has been totally brutal to him, but at the same point, the fact that he couldn't communicate so much or it was difficult for him to move meant he didn't have to teach so much at Cambridge, which meant he had more time for his own work. Like the fact that when he, as a scientist, working out equations is a massive part of his work. But when he was unable to write, he had to create an entirely new way of thinking, of working these things out, which he described as visualizing, like creating those equations through visuals in your own mind. And that idea of reaching beyond, I completely agree. There are no excuses.
I've asked this question of others, obviously, but not of you, so I get a chance now to ask you. You start out this conversation by acknowledging that there was some fear and some trepidation taking this character on. This is the first character you've played who is living?
That's right, yeah.
And so how do you...
How did you navigate your way through just knowing that, whether Stephen Hawking or anyone else, this person is going to see this when it comes up?
Well, it raises your game.
Yeah.
I just saw the potential for me to... I couldn't see a way of it being right, because and as a consequence, it made me just work like ferociously hard and educating myself on the disease, on Stephen's work, and then meeting him, reading around he and Jane's lives, and meeting the children. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the wonder, one of my favorite moments on this was, so I'd spent these months going to an ALS clinic, was trying to be so specifically authentic to the disease, and I was like, very seriously. And then Tim, who is Stephen and Jane's youngest son, who was such a lovely man, and he was like, Ed, no, you must be absolutely true to the disease, but just remember, we did used to get into Dad's wheelchair and use it as a go-kart. Or we would put swear words in his voice machine and press play. And I was like, of course you would. Like, this idea of family living living with humor and with, that was so important. But the reality of knowing Stephen would watch it meant quite a few months of sleepless nights. And the day, I'll never forget the day that he went to see it. I didn't see him afterwards, but I saw him just before. I said, Stephen, look, I'm very nervous. Please, do let me know what you think. And he took a few minutes to write out his response. There's some sweat pouring off me everywhere. and he said, in his iconic voice, he said, I will let you know what I think, good or otherwise, were his words. And I almost died. I was like, okay, Stephen, if it's otherwise, let's just stick to that word. We don't need every single thing that I got wrong.
You were talking about family a moment ago, Eddie. When I saw this, it's obviously, the movie's based on the book, of course, by his first wife, Jane Hawking. But when I saw this, I came away with such, I felt the same way Felicity did. Mm. I came away with such a respect for the love she had for him and the sacrifice. I mean, it's back to your point about these ALS families,
absolutely. This
the person who has the disease has to, trudge through this every day.
Yeah.
But all those persons, those caregivers and all those persons around them, I just said, God bless Jane Hawking.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, as you said, many of the people we met, what's so difficult about it as a disease is that you lose your independence entirely, and you become entirely dependent on someone else. And the guilt or the complications that must come with that when someone is having to do everything for you is really, it's a very complicated thing psychologically, I think, to navigate. But no, you're absolutely right. The caregivers, the people that we met, were really extraordinary, and the work and the dedication, but also the courage and humor was really pretty formidable for Felicity and I to see.
Every actor has, of course, a different approach, a different process for how they do their work. Mm. When you started filming and you got into this character, Stephen Hawking, did you stay in it? Did you come out of it? Was it emotionally debilitating for you? What's your process once you're playing a character?
I wish I had a process. I have no idea what I'm doing.
No, you got to play. Everybody's got one.
No, the interesting thing is that, what's interesting, when you do a stage play, when you do theater, you arrive in a rehearsal room and the director kind of runs the room. Whatever their process is, you fit into that. When you do a film, for those months in preparation, it's kind of in a vacuum, really. Often you don't meet the other actors until a few days or even the day of. And so each time I do a film, I let the character that I'm playing ends up choosing the process. And with this one, I knew that we weren't going to be able to shoot chronologically. Mm-hmm. So I knew that, and we were playing, Felicity and I were playing Jane and Stephen over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So within the same day, we'd have to be playing them at different stages of their lives and at different stages of the of Stephen's ALS. And so I started with the disease and tried to work. I took as many photos as I could of Stephen, mm-hmm. took them to the specialist at the clinic who would analyze and scrutinize those photos and help me work out what his decline may have been. Mm-hmm. Because with ALS, you have what are called upper neurons and lower neurons. And when the upper neurons stop working, there's a kind of rigid quality. And when the lower neurons stop working, there's a sort of softness, mm-hmm. Like a wilting. And how it, ALS is a combination of the two, and how it manifests itself in each patient is different. Mm-hmm. So for example, I went and looked at, there's a video of Stephen doing zero gravity not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time you see him out of the wheelchair, and you can see which parts of his body is stiff and which parts mm-hmm. are soft. So I could use that to help work out what his specific decline may have been. And I then worked with a dancer, a woman called Alex Reynolds, who helped find that and train my body to be able to sustain those positions. And I wanted to learn it like a dance, because what was so important when Felicity and I read the script is it's not a film about a disease mm-hmm. or about a physicality. It's a love story mm-hmm. and a passionate one at that. And we wanted to make sure that the physicality and the way that we related to each other was so sort of second nature that mm-hmm. we didn't have to think about it, because otherwise we thought it might take away from the story.
Strange question, let me ask though. What makes all of this worth it for you? I mean, when we go see a film, mm-hmm. we assume the actors put some work in. But what you've just described here in our conversation thus far, you put a lot of work, a lot of energy, a lot of effort, a lot of learning, to talking to a dance instructor and meeting ALS families. I mean, all the stuff you already detailed, that's a lot to put in to play a character, to be an actor. What makes all that worthwhile?
Well, Charlie Cox, who plays Jonathan, Jane's second husband, mm-hmm. wonderful man. Charlie is an old friend of mine, and when I was cast in this, he called me up and he said, Ed, the wonderful thing about playing someone as extraordinary as Stephen Hawking, having the luck and the fortune to play someone brilliant, is you have no option but to give it 1,000%. Mm-hmm. And he's absolutely right. Like, our dream as actors is to tell interesting stories about interesting people. They don't come as extraordinary as mm-hmm. this. And so I was really aware of how lucky I was. But also because he's formidable, Jane's formidable, I felt like what their story, where there is life, there is hope, which is one of the last things mm-hmm. he says, is such a beautiful message. But beyond that, also meeting many people with ALS. ALS has been around for over 100 years, mm-hmm. and they're still struggling to get closer to finding a reason or a cure. Mm. And I felt that, the Ice Bucket Challenge did amazing things mm-hmm. this year of raising the awareness of the term. But I hoped that our film, although, Stephen has survived against all odds, mm-hmm. Much longer than most people with ALS do, I thought it would help show the reality of living with this disease, rather than just hearing it as a term. I thought people may be interested to see the reality.
Do we know why he has been able to live so long with this?
No. It's so he was given 2 years to live, age 21, and he's now 73.
Yeah.
And people don't know whether it's the specific strain of the illness, because there's a sort of fluid scale in that. Whether it's to do with, he has extraordinary care, but also whether it's, I wouldn't want to make an assumption, but also what he has found great solace in his mind and his capacity to do brilliant things and to sort of, to find and keep expanding into new frontiers mentally as his body has declined. And who knows? I don't know the answer to that.
I'll ask you something that you do know.
Okay.
Which is.
I'm not sure.
No. That was a fine answer. Which is how you are navigating all of this pomp and circumstance. How are you handling it? You seem to be rather well adjusted.
Do I? I don't know about that. I'm just like a duck, like going along calmly underneath. I'm like scrambling away.
You don't look that way.
I feel it.
You handling this okay?
It feels. I always try and put everything I can into the work I do, and I've been working for about 14 years now, and some scripts that you think are wonderful end up not being good films, mm-hmm. and sometimes the other way around, and that rare occasion when something you do comes, you know, fulfills your personal expectations, but also that people seem to enjoy it. It's a wonderful thing. So for me, it's just the most amazing time. Yeah. I'm trying to sort of photograph it all in my mind so that years to come, my wife and I can look back and go, do you remember?
Yes.
back in the day.
And you just got married not too long ago.
Yes. No, really recently.
Yeah. So you got when was it? December?
Yeah, December.
So you got a lot going on all at the same time.
It's all going on. It's a wonderful, frenzied, happy time.
Yeah. How's your family handling all of this?
Oh, they're being amazing.
Yeah.
Except for my poor mum being doorstepped by a journalist the other day unsuspectedly. And sort of slightly falling into the trap of thinking someone would. And anyways, but that is. That's part of the course, I suppose. But no, but they're being so supportive. I think they're as shocked as I am.
Frankly. Yeah, I loved you in the Maryland Project.
Oh, thank you.
That was a great film.
And do you know what was interesting? Actually, it was Michelle Williams in that film having to, play an icon and to navigate the sort of pressures that come with that. She was a great. The way in which she approached it, she's worked with a vocal coach and a movement coach, and she really went to this old school Hollywood way of working. Mm-hmm. And I took that slightly as a pattern mm-hmm. to which to try to approach playing Stephen.
Yeah. Not that you need my encouragement, but The Theory of Everything is something you absolutely want to see. Eddie Redmayne, an honor to have you on this program for the first time. I hope not your last.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.